On this week's episode, we climb aboard the train to Busan. Did we need another Snakes on a Plane movie? Is corporate living the real zombie virus? And are any of us badasses? Find out now. You're listening to 24 Flames Per Second. All aboard, all aboard, everybody. Welcome to 24 Flames Per Second, a podcast that roasts the films we love the most. And as always, I'm your host, Robert Spiewak, and welcome to our very own train to Busan. It's a connecting train, and we will get there as we continue through October this year. Horror movie season, which is probably on average our favorite season across the pool of everybody we've got, and I'm sure I said that before. I'll say it again this month. And so, yeah, everybody, thanks for tuning in, thanks for joining us, and we are gonna keep on getting into it with this Halloween stuff. But before we do, we'll figure out some kind of hot take that we're gonna put up on our Patreon. This weekend, depends on what's coming out, but yeah, head over to patreon.com/24flamespod and we will see if we can't tell you about some new movies coming out to streaming, probably, because I'm not going to a theater. You're out of your mind if you're going to a theater right now. Hot take. But yeah, everybody, head over there, check that out, and we'll see what kind of movies are coming out. But yeah, back to Train to Busan, 2016 South Korean zombie movie. And yeah, we're gonna get into it, starting with the estranged wife to my homeless mister, Casey Robb.
Oh, hello.
Hello, how's it going?
It's going good. It's been a busy week, and the smoke is definitely a new layer of apocalypse in our current apocalypse, so hoping we don't add zombies.
Yeah, when we were recording this, there was, San Francisco is red/orange. The smoke's making its way to Seattle. You've got it in eastern Washington. Mm-hmm. It's, everyone's dying.
Yes.
Put it lightly. But yeah, that's just where we're at. We continue podcasting through the apocalypse. Casey, did you watch the movie this week?
I did. I will take any opportunity to watch this movie and most Korean movies.
Wow. Well, what do you know about it?
So this movie was directed by Sang Ho Yeon. And this was actually the director's first live action film. So there is a canonical prequel called Soul Station that is animated.
That's right.
That was a short film that he created. And it takes place in the same world. And then there's also a sequel that may have come out in Korea. I'm not really clear on that. It was supposed to come out in July, but obviously, you know,
yeah,
coronavirus. So I'm not sure if it came out in Korea and not elsewhere, but we certainly have not gotten it here in the U.S. yet. It's called Peninsula. And Peninsula is kind of a slang for the entire country of Korea, or South Korea specifically, because it's on a peninsula. So it sounds like it takes place about 4 years after this film, and the scale is much larger. So I'm definitely really excited to see that.
Yeah.
And then the other fun fact, I think, like I said, I'm really into Korean film. My sister lived in Korea for a year teaching English, and I was able to visit her there. So we eat a lot of Korean food in my family, that we have a connection to Korea through her. And this movie was kind of on the precipice of Korean film being really popular in the States. It came out right around the same time as The Wailing. Burning came shortly after, and then of course we all know Parasite, Oscar winner for best film, among others. So you could almost say that Train to Busan was like the leading force in Korean film kind of really picking up in the U.S.
And yeah, it did release in South Korea in July.
Okay, good to know.
That's all it did. So we'll see it someday, I think. But yeah, that's all great stuff. Thanks for sharing.
Of course.
And I think without any further ado, we'll get on with introducing the panels this week, starting with the roasters, as always. First up, director of photography and Tracer. You can find his work on Instagram and Twitter at Grayson Arts. Russell, hey.
Hello. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing great. I am so ready to talk about this movie.
Yeah. We're ready to hear you talk about it. Well, thank you for being here.
Of course.
And also on the roasting panel, filmmaker and political activist. You can find him on Instagram and Twitter at True Cody Olson. Cody Olson.
Am I on Instagram? Hello, everybody.
Yeah, there's a one following me.
Okay.
Maybe it's not. Maybe it's a false Cody Olson.
That's a false idol. You know what it is? Actually, I made an Instagram account. I didn't know it was with that handle. Literally, there's a guy in Seattle who plays the violin, and I now have ran into him enough where I like kind of know where he's gonna be. But I'd ran into him once, like in the early days of the pandemic, and it was just like, it was hitting me hard, and it was just this like beautiful thing. I went to watch the sunset and he was playing He told me his Instagram handle. And I was like, I need to be able to listen to this again. And so there's no post on there just so I could find this guy. And I got messages from people like Jacob, who's like, are you on Instagram now? I was like, well, kind of. So anyway, I have no clue what the handle is even. I just needed to find him. Like, all right, cool.
Well, maybe you can't find him on Instagram, but he's on Twitter.
I have on Twitter. That part is true.
Nevertheless, thank you for being here for Train to Busan.
Yeah.
And on the defense this week, actor and DM Dungeon Master to the stars. You can find him on Twitter at not Chris Evans, Evan Christopher.
Hey, Robert.
Hey,
it's good to be here.
Yeah, how's it going?
How's it going? All right. I'm keeping my energy low before I get into this. And that way I can just explode later on.
Okay. I am excited to see how that goes for you.
That's probably a bad tactic.
Anyway, it's fine. Anyways, it's great to have you here. You know how this goes. First things first, we'll do movie in a minute. We'll give you 60 seconds and a three count to give us the full plot synopsis of Train to Busan. Spoilers and all. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Okay. Here we go in 3, 2, 1, go.
Our lead character, Sok Woo, is a fund manager for a multi-conglomerate company. He is a rich but somewhat inattentive father to his daughter, Soo-an. Soo-an just really wants to go and see her mother, and she kind of feels a distance between her father as his work life has kind of separated them, also causing her mother to end up divorcing him. So he ends up taking her on a train to Busan to go and see their mother. Along the way, there is two people that sneak on board this train, an old homeless man as well as an infected woman who ends up turning into an infected person and starts eating people on the way, causing the passengers to have to kind of come together. Along this time, there are several pitfalls that they run into, is a couple of stations that they stop at, running into more zombies as they try to escape. The main character, Sok Woo, ends up losing faith from his daughter's point of view until eventually kind of having his own evolution and eventually becoming into a much more better human being. Towards the end, end up sacrificing the devil
and
on a soldier.
Out of damn. Time. Wait, what was the last thing you just said?
Oh, he fights his own devil on his shoulder to then sacrifice himself for his daughter.
Okay. Yeah. But yeah, in the midst of, you know, moving back and forth from train to train, car to car. At the end, he does eventually get bit and has to leave his daughter with a pregnant wife of another character.
Sung Kyung.
Yeah. And he takes a spill off the back of that train and lets them go on to safety, which, they get to the end of the line. There's military, a bunker or some kind of sniper stand set up where they can see down the tunnel. And thankfully the, lady and the daughter are not sniped. They get rescued, or at least brought into where the military is all holed up there. And that's where the movie leaves us. So yeah, that's Train to Busan, everybody. And so, yeah, very good. Evan, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll get your opening statement. Or it's why you're here defending Train to Busan. Everybody, we'll see you then. We'll be right back. And we're back, everybody. Welcome back to our Train to Busan episode as Horror Month keeps rolling along down the tracks. Evan made it up to one of the saddest moments in a movie I've ever seen in my life. But no further. And so, Evan, let's get your opening statements. Why you're here defending Train to Busan.
Yes, I believe that Train to Busan is probably one of the better zombie movies around this particular time of like the aughts. Aught-tens, because through most American zombie movies that we have now, they're not really horror anymore. They've turned more into an action kind of deal, that our characters typically have some kind of plot armor that's going to protect them. I mean, the closest movie to this one that had come out before that was World War Z, where we had Brad Pitt, who we knew that Brad Pitt wasn't going to end up dying in the movie. At the same point, you also have all the Resident Evil movies. Then you got I know your favorite director is Zack Snyder, who did Dawn of the Dead. So they've all turned into this like just more of like a disaster film instead of an actual horror film. This one, they change it up quite a bit because it kind of goes within taking stabs at Korean culture and itself, which I also kind of noticed does have some parallels to our own culture as well, of very much keeping to themselves, which allows the infected person to get onto the actual train until eventually getting more people infected because they just decide to ignore it until it becomes a problem. You also have, you know, the attacks against the homeless people. And you also have this a mass amount of fear mongering that happens that gets the people to go against what would be as a better person, as we would all believe that when a zombie apocalypse would happen, that we would be, you know, heroes and look out for each other, where more often than not, we probably end up being very scared and actually being extremely selfish, as this movie goes to show. And that's just going for the major points of the movie. I have several other ones for the main characters, but I'll get into that later.
Okay. Well, very good. I think, you know, you led off with talking about this genre. This movie is part of the genre, the zombie movie genre. So, Roasters, mm-hmm. I think that is a very good place for us to start. Russell and or Cody, who would like to go first? Russell.
Well, so, okay. First of all, at the time that this came out, I feel like we were kind of at the tail end of zombie movies as a particularly strong genre just in general. And I don't really actually see that they advanced the genre at all with this movie. Like it's pretty bog standard when it comes to like all of the tropes of a zombie movie. And the only thing that made it stand out and different is, oh my, they're on a train. And so like, I actually like, I think that this holds to what you were saying about it being more of an action movie, because it is more of an action movie. I don't see really any aspects of horror in this beyond the fact that it's like layered on with zombies instead of Nazis as the bad guy. Right. And so like, I didn't really feel that like that it did enough to stand out. Yes, it played into, you know, some of the Korean cultural aspects. And I think that yes, that makes it different because it is a Korean movie. It's not an American movie, but it's still like it feels flat to me when it comes to really advancing zombie as a genre.
Evan, you had your hand up.
Yes. So where I cannot deny that there is action scenes that would happen within most zombie films, we are going to have some kind of action scene, as the monster itself is typically more of a horde kind of deal than it's going to be just one individual monster. This one, I think, kind of is I think, a stronger version, only because within most zombie films that we can usually think of, like I'm just going to say off the top of my head for most of the time, Dawn of the Dead, Resident Evil, how about Zombieland as well. Within most American movies, we have what always happens, guns. Lots and lots of guns, which have lots and lots of bullets and shooting that happens. In this movie, there is not a single gun to be found, also because of South Korean culture, which makes it a lot more nerve-wracking because within the times that they have to fight, they are having to really do it hand-to-hand within most of the time. There's no long-range weapons that they're able to defend themselves with. With this also that they had for this movie, they added in a way to get around the zombies to having them being so clustered inside them for having the sense of being blinded, kind of like in the same way, I guess you could look at it in the same way of having T-Rex senses. If you don't move, they can't see you. So I think that within that, it kind of creates a small advantage for the humans at one point from this massive horde that's able to come at you, because these zombies that they have in this movie are much more, I think, scary than we've seen for other ones, where a lot of them that we saw have been like very CGI'd. These people have actually had some kind of special contortion that have that weird movement that just seems very jarring for us to watch as you can see them transform.
Russell, go ahead.
Okay, so I guess there's a couple of things that I want to address about that specifically. So like if we look at zombie movies as a genre, like a movie that I think moved the genre forward is 27 Days Later. I'm probably mistaking the number. 28 Days. Thank you. I'm really bad with numbers. And like, so I think that moved the zombie genre forward because it introduced new and interesting concepts, right? I don't think that them having to fight hand to hand is really like, yeah, there were no guns because, you know, they aren't a gun, Korea is not a gun forward culture like America is, right? But in a lot of zombie movies, the guns end up failing. The guns end up not being as effective as they need to be, or for whatever reason, they can't use them because they make noise, they move different zombies, or, you know, get the horde to them because of sound. Like, the fighting hand to hand happens in most zombie movies, even American zombie movies. And so, like, sure, they had bats. Sure, they had sticks. You know, they wrapped their arms so that they wouldn't get bit. But none of these things are really out of place in any other zombie movie that came before it, as well as zombie movies that have come after it. And so, like, I don't think that the cultural difference there, which really, let's talk about this, is that it is a cultural difference between America and Korea, that there aren't guns present because they aren't gun crazy the way Americans are. Like, that's a cultural difference based on where the movie was made and where the movie was set. And I don't think that that necessarily added anything beyond the cultural context.
Cody, I know you also had something to say about, like, I don't know, the zombie rules that they kind of just, you know, thunder right on through in the movie.
Yeah, to me, it seems like I think this movie begins with a predisposition of assuming that you have seen other movies in the genre, which for us, I think, on the panel, that's true. But there was a part of me that almost wanted the movie to be a little more insular in establishing its own mythology and not assuming people have seen zombies. I think they get a bit better at it maybe as the movie goes on, but it seems I'm trying to compare it to other zombie movies I've seen, and I feel like there's a bit more of a learning curve for the audience and for the characters in the movie. But when they see the very first zombie, it goes from 0 to 60 pretty quickly. And so, yeah, I guess I just maybe wanted the film to feel more self-contained than sort of you have to do required reading and be a fan of this genre already coming into it.
Yeah, Evan, go ahead.
I feel like I have to disagree. I think in the first 2 minutes, you actually get to see a zombie right off the bat, not a zombie human, mind you. But we do see that there's the chemical spill that ends up happening very first in the beginning that they talk about. And the guy gets very mad about livestock, and then he hits something, has no idea what it is. We see that it turns out to be a deer, and then the deer actually goes through the same changes that we see the zombies go through eventually in the beginning, that turns into the blind kind of deer that's become reanimated. You also get to see, once he starts driving through, that there's some fights that end up happening up on the train, like on the train platform, and you actually get to see one of the people get attacked as the train's taking off, that Su-An notices. At the same time, you can also see that the government is trying to quash the whole thing throughout the movie and saying there's nothing to panic about, there's nothing to worry, as we can see that there's also been, I think they were talking about a strike in the beginning that then turned into riots, because you can also hear that the two elderly sisters at one point were talking about that and how they all need to be re-educated, that they wouldn't have done that back in their time, which is another kind of a generational gap that you can see within this movie that they have, of the older generation to the newer generation, that ends up getting the older generation sacrificing the newer generation so that they can survive on, comparably to the newer generation having to take on the burden that the older generation has put upon them.
Cody.
Yeah, I think you have a good point there, Evan, with the examples that they show. I would still, though, point out the first woman who gets on the train with a bite and goes in the bathroom and secludes herself. From that point, I think we understand what's happening because we're familiar with zombie movies and we know that she's been bitten by something and, you know, and that's bad. But I was trying to put myself in the place of, you know, someone who enjoys stories but hasn't watched many of these stories before, like maybe a grandparent or something like that. And I guess that element of it just frustrated me, that I don't think that, I think you're right, Evan, the film, it shows that zombie early on, it communicates a lot of things, but I don't think it communicates the bite transmission. It kind of just assumes that we understand, oh, bite transmission, that's how this goes. And so I guess I could see somebody wanting to be invested in this movie, but having more questions than they want to have in the first act. And that always frustrates me a bit, because I think a strong film should stand on its own as much as it can.
Yeah. Evan.
Well, I have a question, because I think I'm a little confused. So what you're saying is that you would like for them to have at some point an expository scene explaining exactly what a zombie is, or what it is. Because I know that it's been brought up before. I think Russell had made a good point beforehand that there doesn't seem to be, at all of these zombie movies, there never ever seems to be a point where that anybody ever brings up the term zombie. That they just kind of like think it's some kind of madness or something like that. However, I think that not only within the culture of America, but I think within the world, that zombie has become just as unanimous of a monster as Frankenstein, Dracula, the Wolfman. I mean, probably even more than the Wolfman, because we've seen over the last decade or so forth that zombies have become extremely popular, not only in just B films, but you had like The Walking Dead, you've got comics, Nazi zombies. Like as Russell said before, the zombie genre has been somewhat very overplayed. I think one of the bigger points of this movie is that even though the zombies are a threat, the bigger thing that I enjoy about this movie the most is being able to see the evolution of the character that Suk-young ends up having.
Yeah. Cody.
Yeah, I think you have a good point, Evan. And again, I understand the film, and I think we all understand the film, and fans of the genre do. But I'm taking issue with what feels like storytelling that's playing too much insider baseball, that is saying you have to come with this knowledge of the lore. And that frustrates me, because I want the film to function on its own merits. And again, for us, great, we have this knowledge baked in. But I want the film to be able to do the lifting so that I could show it to a parent or a grandparent, and they wouldn't have questions that I think that they might have about the nature of zombies and how they're functioning in this world. It kind of, the film almost is just like, runs by and it's kind of like, you're either in or you're out right now. And I just maybe I was in, you know, to a degree. It was like, I get it, sure. But I don't like only playing to fans of the genre. I like films that extend an olive branch and go, even if this is your very first zombie movie, come on this ride. We're going to tell a story and we're going to make it understandable.
Cody, if you don't mind me asking another question, because of being such fans that we are, could you give me an example of something more of like what you're talking about, just for my edification, please?
I don't know if I can, because it's been a minute since I've seen another zombie movie. So that's like the crack in my argument, maybe, is there's not a great comparison that I have for this, just because this is by far the freshest in my brain. It's been a few years for most other sort of popular zombie movies that I've seen. But so for me, I'm speaking in a broad sentiment. I can't point to, that one scene in 28 Days Later. But what I can say is my favorite zombie movies, I came away from them going, that was a whole experience. And, you know, for one type of zombie movie, there's this set of rules. For another type of zombie movie, there's this set of rules. For this one, it seemed like it was just drafting off of the pre-established set of relatively fast zombie rules. And it went, all right, great. We don't really have to do too much zombie world building.
I want to make sure that we get to this in the time that we have, but let's talk about some characters, starting with the dad, who I don't remember his name off the top of my head, but Roasters. Evan, I saw you on mute. You got a name for me?
Oh, yeah. It's Sakwu.
Okay, perfect. But yeah, Roasters. We were going to talk about the dad. Who would like to go first? Not all at once. Cody.
Yeah. So the dad is presented at the start as this, I don't know if deadbeat dad is too strong, but this guy who's kind of a workaholic, who has a young daughter and maybe doesn't pay enough attention to her. He's a divorcee. And it's not that I don't think that's compelling. For me, there are a couple issues with it. It seems like around the midpoint of the film, the dad becomes this sort of empathetic protagonist that we'd want to have. And to me, it almost feels like the film knew he would get there and it just kind of wanted him to go on a bit of a journey. But I think that they maybe dropped the ball in the casting a bit, because I think the actor portraying this character, for the physicality of him and just the way he delivers lines, even though he's saying mean lines, he never struck me as that mean of a person. And that's maybe just my reading of the film, but I didn't find myself like really, really going, oh my God, this guy needs to learn a lesson, even though I knew some of the actions he was taking were wrong. And so I just sort of felt like I think the film casted him poorly and could have cast somebody that maybe inhabited the physicality of just somebody who is like, wow, this person, even when they say something, I can just sort of feel the venom on their, you know, on their tongue. And I want them to be more empathetic. From the beginning, I felt like that was there and I wanted it to be less of a predetermined destiny, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Russell.
Yeah. So for me, like the dad is interesting, like an interesting character, because I saw him as like at the beginning of the film up until there's one point where I'm just like, okay, the dad's a piece of shit. But before this point, and we'll talk about this point in a second, but before this point, like the dad just felt like, okay, he's disconnected from his daughter, cause he works a lot. He's trying to provide for her. There's obviously been a recent divorce. And his mom is there taking care of his daughter because he's working to give them the life that he thinks that they should have, right? So that was my read on the dad at the beginning. Then they get on the train and, you know, he's like, the daughter's obviously upset about not being able to go see her mom. And so he takes her on the train. He shows that he's a good person who thinks about other people. And then immediately when they make it to the first town, when they get off of the train and he says, or maybe it's on the train, I don't remember exactly where it happens, but he's like, you have to only think about yourself. Hmm. Like that point was a complete shift in his character, and not in a way that seemed coherent with the way that the character was set up from the very beginning. Then he showed he was selfish for a good little while. And then he then started thinking about everyone else. Right. And so like his character arc is he's, you know, maybe a little driven in his career to try to take care of his daughter and provide for his daughter. Then he's an asshole. And then, oh, look, he cares about everyone. And it just didn't feel, it didn't feel organic. It felt very forced to me.
Okay. Casey, I think you were next.
Yeah, I just wanted to maybe offer a little context here. And again, this is like third hand information because my sister is the person who lived in Korea and she's not Korean. She's white and American, but her read on the movie and the relationships was a little different than what I had seen the first time because of that context. And something that I thought was really interesting is it's pretty common for men in Korea to work a lot and also to work in cities that are not the city that they live in. And so it's pretty common for kids to grow up there not seeing their dads all that often. I think that the non-common part of this is more the fact that they were actually divorced, which is rarer there. So I thought that was kind of interesting. But also what you're saying about being selfish, I think that's a bigger moment than maybe we understand because Korea is a collectivist society and they think, you know, for the good of the group, for the good of Koreans, for the good of the nation, more often than they think about for the good of themselves. And so I think that's a really interesting moment when he tells her, basically, you have to only look out for yourself because that's a survival instinct coming through. And I think that's important context. So I just wanted to throw it out there. And I think that something about watching foreign films is that sometimes we do have to do a little more research to understand some of those moments and why they might be important.
Okay. It's good to know. Cody, you had your hand up.
Yeah, that was a great point, Casey, and some good context. I was just thinking about what Russell said, and I think he articulated well what I was trying to articulate. And it's maybe the reason why I think the casting is off is also that the dad, there are certain activities, they present this hardworking dad, and kind of like Russell said, he is working too much in terms of he's not paying attention to his kid enough. But by the same token, he's also working hard to try to provide a good life for his kid. And so at times, the movie would almost seem to be condemning him more than I myself wanted to. And there's even a line where early on when the outbreak happens, the other bigger guy, he goes, oh, he's a fund manager. What a bloodsucker. And I guess I was like, wait a second. I mean, we can talk about the sort of ethics and morality of different positions in the working world. But at the end of the day, a job is a job. You need to provide for your kid. And so there was a part of me that was like, shut up, dude. Like, this person's working hard and they're just trying to provide for their kid. I hesitate to hate them for that. Nor are they the CEO of some massive company, right? They're middle management. They're not the CEO. So they're not like Jeff Bezos or something like that. Their power is relatively limited within the institution of this company.
Interesting. Evan, responses to all of it.
All right. So this is going to probably be a long tangent, but so Sok-woo, yes, we can tell he is a hardworking man, and we can see in the beginning that he actually is willing to put the company line before other people when he goes to make those merger offers right off the beginning. We can see that he is more for the company than he is for the single man. We can also see that he does somewhat care for his daughter, but because of his so busy trying to like create a supportive life so that she can have everything, that he ends up in some way neglecting her. So at the point in which you can see that he bought her a Wii for her birthday, but he also just bought her a Wii earlier for Children's Day. So when she asks him of, hey, I want to go see mom in Busan, that's him saying, okay, I'm going to falter to this. And then I will take you to Busan because you're a child. You can't go by yourself. And I will take you to mom. And then he's going to come back. Along the same time, you can see that he has a lot of cowardice in the beginning. He does look towards Yon Suk, the greedy COO of Stallion Enterprises, when he's making the phone calls to the other stations ahead of time, in which you can also see later on that Sok Woo calls his own guys to try to get past quarantine. So that way they don't get stuck in quarantine. And that's a point where you can see with him when Su-an, his daughter, when she ends up seeing, like, you can see there are points where Su-an is losing respect for her father. Like when he tells her, hey, you shouldn't have done that to give the seat to the lady. She ends up, she's disappointed in her father because they also are supposed to respect their elders, you know, and pointed to getting the seat. Later on, again, when he gets to the Daejeon station and he tries to get past the quarantine, she wants to go and tell the others, and he goes, no, because, you know, it can only do for them, and he knows that, but she doesn't understand that, and so she views it as being selfish. Thus, she ends up losing more respect for him. And like I said, Sok-woo, he has this mentality where he kind of identifies at first with the asshole character, because you can see him try to close the door beforehand on the people that still were surviving, and then lets them in just a bit later. But then later on, when his daughter and all of them get on back at Daejeon Station and have to fight their way through, he ends up becoming the target of Yon Suk's fear-mongering to everybody else and calling them all out, saying that, you know, look at the, you know, they're infected, you need to get out of here. And he can see now the sense of selfishness and the fear that everybody has to then shuttle them all in the back, where he has this change moment because he has just gone through hell and back to get his daughter to safety. He has recreated with Sang-hwa, who actually had confided with him of that one day his daughter will understand the sacrifices that he has made. And you can see that he is becoming somewhat more of a better person along the way, because he's not really ever the hero archetype. We see that more with Sang-hwa, the auxiliary character, later on, as he's kind of more of the badass. Sok-woo isn't a badass. He's more of who we are now, because none of us are badasses. So eventually, towards the end, when you see him make his final sacrifice for his daughter, he doesn't end up having a painful changeover. You get to see his last moments, remembering when his daughter was born and having a smile on his face before he throws himself off the train, so that way his daughter can understand the sacrifices that he has made, not only just of him throwing himself off the train, but all the time that he had spent, so that way she could have a good life.
Russell.
Okay, that was a lot, but I have one question for you, Evan. Do you actually think that at the beginning of the movie, Su-an actually has any respect for her father?
I do, because we see in the beginning when she had her recital, she was going to sing Aloha A, right? And she's kind of trepidly starts singing it, but then kind of gives up and is embarrassed by the rest of the kids there, because she says in the car when he had asked her about it that he wasn't there, and she had specifically done that just for him, that she had wanted to learn that song so she could, you know, impress him, and she wanted to do a good job. Now, later on in the movie, when, you know, Sok-woo has passed on and now it's just Su-an and Seong-kae-young walking down that tunnel, they are about to get shot by the military because they can't tell who the zombies are and who's real from an off of a distance. But only until we actually get to hear Su-an start singing Aloha A, the song that she was going to sing for her father, which she sings, I guess, in a way of honoring her father, saves them in the end from being shot.
Russell.
So we don't find out about the Aloha A until later on in the movie, after she has actually started to respect her father. That doesn't happen in the car. I don't remember exactly what point that happened, but I know she told him that only after the zombies had started to attack.
He sees her singing it in class on the tape the grandma took at the recital.
Right, yep. Yeah, but she doesn't tell him that she only learned it for him until towards the end of the movie or somewhere in the middle of the movie. So I still don't see that Su-an actually has any respect for her father, even though he is trying to make a good life for her.
Well, and I think that's also a point that we should try to look at. That's one of the things that I also have a strong tie to this movie about, is that I think a lot of us, when we're younger, feel like with parents that are workaholics, you know, that they they aren't really giving us enough attention, and it's not until we get older that we can realize about how much work they put forth and how much they tried to give us a good life, especially during the times that we're in now. And so I think that we don't really get to see Su-Wan say that, because Su-Wan is a child and doesn't really understand that. Not until this particular horrifying event happens that Su-Wan is having to grow up in some way to then have to realize that.
This sucks, but we're out of time to continue arguing about this. So we're going to have to go ahead, and it's time to unmask, and we'll talk about how we really feel. And so there will be more on the extended play, everybody. Don't you worry listening. I'll start with you, Evan. Unmask. Let's go.
Oh, I love this movie. It's a really great movie. It's one of the few movies that I constantly suggest to people to watch if they want to really get into South Korean movies. I also highly suggest check out The Host at some point, please.
Yeah. Russell.
Okay, so I did not see this movie before agreeing to roast it, and holy crap, I loved this movie. So this is my first time watching it, and I signed up for this not even knowing that it was a zombie movie, and then like within the first scene where the deer gets shot or gets hit, mm-hmm. and comes back to life, and I'm like, this is a zombie movie? And yeah, no, this was it was hard to roast this. Like, I was pulling out like all the little things that bothered me. But overall, this is such an amazing film. Absolutely loved it.
Got him. Cody.
Same. I really like this movie. Yes. We watched it, I think, for a drink along back in the earlier days of coronavirus. I want to say that was May or something. So I loved it then and still love it. I think my criticisms are things that I do think and are true, but in no way tanked the movie for me. And it's one of my favorite zombie movies that I've seen, and I think it's just such an effective. It both feels big and small in the right ways.
Nice, Casey.
I absolutely loved this movie the first time I saw it. I loved it the second and most recent times I saw it. I think that it's a really effective zombie movie, a really effective intro for someone who's maybe not sure if they would be interested in reading subtitles or foreign films or Korean films specifically. I think that the setting, which we barely even talked about, is so important. One of my favorite horror movies of all time is The Descent. And so that kind of like claustrophobic, contained film is really effective to me. I think after this most recent rewatch, it's probably in my top 10 of like all movies of all time.
Wow. And yeah, it won't surprise anybody. I love this movie too. Ever since, I think the first time I saw it was in the first year of our 24-hour horror marathon. It was like our sunrise movie, I think. And Kwesi and I, we wrapped up. We looked over and we were both just crying watching the movie. It was very good. I think it slaps. It's good stuff all around. The characterization, the setting, the way it deals with the zombie canon and has, I don't know, more zombies to mess with you and stuff. I just think it's great. Everybody. So that's gonna do it for our Train to Busan episode. And as I mentioned, we're going to keep talking for our extended play, which is our post show. It's just for our Patreon supporters. So if you want to help support the show and get a bunch of that stuff, more extended plays, drink alongs, more hot takes, you can do that. Head over to patreon.com/24flamespod. And if you got thoughts about Train to Busan, you can email us at 24flamespod@gmail.com. You can find us on social media at 24flamespod. And wherever you get your podcasts, go leave a rating, review, subscribe for all the next stuff that we got coming out. So more people can find the show. We can make the show better, all that stuff. It's one big positive feedback loop. Everybody. And as I mentioned before, we got a hot take coming this weekend for some new movie, TBD. Coming out, probably just streaming, that we'll talk about. And yeah, so this episode of 24 Flames Per Second is produced and hosted by me, Robert Spiewak, co-hosted by Casey Rom. Panels this week were on the Roasters, Russell Hay and Cody Olson, and the defense was Evan Christopher. Our show music was produced and performed by Rob Joins and Will Paulson. And our network and co-op, Partyfish Media, is produced by Quasi Phillips, Will Paulson, and myself, everybody. And so we're going to keep moving right on down the track through horror season this year. Next week, we are doing another zombie movie, 28 Days Later, as we mentioned on the show even earlier. So come on back for that next week, everybody. And if we don't hear from you between now and then, have a good week. And we'll see you then, everybody. Thanks for listening, and see you later. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Choo-choo.
Choo-choo, motherfucker.
Partyfish Media acknowledges that it operates and records on Indigenous Duwamish and Puget Sound Coast Salish land that is still home to the Duwamish tribe. This land is stolen in violation of the Point Elliott Treaty of 1855. We are committed to uplifting the name of these lands and community members from these nations who reside alongside us. For more information on this land, its people, or ways you can help, visit duwamishtribe.org or realrentduwamish.org.